But then he seemed to decide to just go with it and shrugged, like if I didn't like the term, I could say something about it. And, I mean, the word was silly, but did I mind the concept? Not really. I squeezed Christopher closer to me as I thought about what I extra wanted to do. Things have been so busy lately that I hadn't really given it any thought. I ran through multiple options involving all my favorite things, interspersed with Christopher, naked. Finally, all those things coalesced into the vision of waking up with Christopher on a lazy morning and lying in bed, then eating breakfast and having nothing to do all day. It had never happened, because he'd been opening the shop early and I'd been painting in the mornings, but the second I thought of it, it became a kind of personal goal. I didn't let myself ruin it by pointing out that it might be rather pathetic to have as a relationship goal eating a bowl of cereal with someone. I just went with a version of it that I could have. Okay. I want a cereal bar. Breakfast cereals. All of them. So I can mix and match and make different combinations in my bowl. And I want you to eat it with me. If you want. That's all you want for your birthday? That's exactly what I want for my birthday. And cereal ain't cheap, mister. Not the brand name stuff, anyway. Christopher chuckled and held his hands up. Okay, if that's what you want. What about if you make me a list of cereals you want, and I'll go get them and meet you upstairs? I grinned at him and quickly scribbled down every cereal I liked. Oh, and I don't know what it is, but there's some granola in the Whole Foods bulk bins that tastes like pancakes or maple syrup, I guess. Can I have that, too? Christopher shook his head at me. Sweetheart, it's New Year's Eve. Whole Foods closed. He looked at his watch. 5 minutes ago. Probably only Acme is open now. Oh, right. Time. I made the list, and then I made eyes at him and pulled him in, hands on his hips. I slid the list into his back pocket and gave his ass a possessive squeeze while I was there. I assume you have no milk, he said, leaning into me. You assume correctly. He kissed me, deeper than he usually did in public, and snuck a hand around for a little grope of his own. Your wish is my command, he murmured against my lips, but I didn't have to die of cheesiness because he gave me a dark, filthy look that clearly said I should start thinking about all the other things I wanted to demand. When I got upstairs an hour later, Christopher had lined up the boxes of cereal on the coffee table. Wow! It was more cereal than I had ever seen outside a grocery store, and he'd gotten regular milk and almond milk, which I sometimes liked better because it had that nutty taste. I may have added a few to the mix. He handed me a spoon and a bowl that wasn't mine. I also bought cereal bowls because if you want a mix, your bowls are useless, way too shallow. I kissed him. Damn, you're an expert. Oh, of course. I attended culinary school. He winked. I put on music and we talked as we tried out different cereal combinations. I think I stand by my combo of Cinnamon Toast Crunch Peanut Butter Panda Puffs and a sprinkling of Honey Nut Cheerios with almond milk, I said later, collapsing on the bed in exhaustion, in a position where I still had a good view of Christopher and all the cereal boxes. Because it seemed hard to be anything but pretty damn satisfied with those as my view. I still can't believe you love cereal, but you don't like Lucky Charms. Lucky Charms taste like that space ice cream, and I don't like fruity stuff. He shook his head at me and closed up all the boxes, taking our bowls to the kitchen. When he slid into bed beside me, I was already half unconscious, lulled into a stupor by the twin forces of a busy day and a metric ton of cereal. Hey... Midnight happened and we didn't even notice, he said. Happy New Year. Happy New Year, I mumbled. Thanks for the cereal. You're welcome. Happy birthday. He kissed the back of my neck until I moaned and I tangled our legs together. He pushed up on one elbow, as if he were going to say something else, but lay down and gathered me close without saying a word. I drifted off in his arms after we'd eaten cereal together, like I was living a perfect day in reverse.
Christopher. Christopher.
Bro, I'm so fucking in love, it's not funny. She's it for me, I swear. You like her, right? Christopher. Jay? You okay? Christopher. Hey, anything cool? Christopher. Jude, you still here?
Chapter 18. 2 days after my serial birthday party, I jolted out of a deep sleep as if to a loud noise, but there was nothing. It was still dark, about an hour before sunrise, but I was totally awake. It happened sometimes, if I was really busy or needed to finish a project, my body taking on a kind of hypervigilance. My art show was in a week and a half. I forced myself to breathe slowly at the thought. I flicked on my phone to see the time and was greeted by an endless scroll of notifications, far more than usual, even lately with United Inc. going strong. And these were not good. It all seemed to trace back to a rant that Eddie Sparks had posted last night. It was littered with all caps, bad grammar, and a lot of emojis, and it essentially accused Eddie Blake and me of being melodramatic man-haters with no sense of humor who clearly only got where we were in the business by sleeping with people, since we were talentless hacks who should probably just hide away with other women if we couldn't take a little healthy competition. My blood pressure rose with each garbled sentence, and I was shouting at the internet before I was even halfway done. Then I got mad all over again with each comment I read that agreed with him. Each male tattoo artist who confirmed that, yeah, he didn't like to hire women because they were too moody and sensitive, and it made the vibe in the shop no fun because you always had to tiptoe around them. Or, yeah, in his experience, men gave jobs to female tattooists because they were fucking and they didn't want to miss out on getting laid. Then the industry was stuck with them. Yep, it sucked to have to be politically correct and hire women, even though they weren't as good and got upset if you tried to correct them. It was all shit I'd heard 1,000 times before, both within the industry and without. But seeing such a concentrated stew of hatred was like sandpaper over a wound that never truly healed. There were comments that disagreed with him, too, but the shitty ones seemed to yell 100 times louder and cut 100 times deeper. I fumed for a while, ranting and saying, "What the fuck is wrong with people?" about 60,000 times. And then, when none of that made me feel any better, putting on Tom Waits, who never failed to soothe, amuse, and depress me in equal measure. Then I put on a double-strength pot of coffee, sat down on the floor, and started to compose my reply as the sun rose, because I was done with playing nice. I was done with positive spin. I was done taking the fucking high road when the stink of shit rose to meet it. I didn't care if it cost me public opinion or customers or even the money I needed to buy the shop. I had a piece to say, and I wasn't going anywhere until I'd said it. The shop was a madhouse. We were trying to see clients, but Lindsay was giving us real-time updates from her station behind the computer at the front desk as Tara gave parallel updates from her phone. My comments in response to Eddie Sparks had been things I'd talked about with Tara and Daniel and Etta, and with those who'd shared their stories through United Inc. They'd been things most women in the industry already knew, intuitively, if not explicitly, that in an industry run by men, women were set up to compete with each other for a place at the table, that this culture of competition framed women artists as adversaries rather than allies and put us in positions where we were at risk of losing our livelihoods and our communities if we challenged the status quo, that especially for young women new to the business, like the artist Eddie Sparks sexually harassed, the industry was a place where we sometimes had to choose between doing what we loved and getting to feel comfortable and safe, that unless the industry took it upon itself to change, to hold people like Eddie Sparks accountable, it was as good as condoning discrimination and sexual violence. Okay, sure. Then I called Eddie Sparks out directly for leveraging his power to keep women too intimidated to report him for his disgusting and illegal behavior. And I called him a pathetic dinosaur so afraid of actually being judged for his art that he hid behind starting drama among actual artists. Then I called him a douchebag. And a creep. And I didn't regret any of it. My comments had made the rounds unbelievably fast, and I figured that Etta Blake had something to do with that. Ed emailed her right after I'd posted. I was anxious and angry and elated by turns, depending on the updates, and I hated the feeling that strangers on the internet had the power to change my mood so completely with one comment. After a few hours, when I took a break to pee and grab a drink, I checked my notifications to see all the things Lindsay and Tara hadn't updated us about. Unsurprisingly, it was all the epically filthy and aggressive things that people were saying, with comments ranging from how I probably just wanted to do tattoos so I could get fucked by a bunch of men, to how I was hideous and disgusting and I was just bitter because no one wanted to fuck me. I powered my phone off and dumped it in the drawer of my tattoo station, determined not to look at it until I'd finished up for the night. The last thing I wanted was to be distracted while I was putting permanent art on someone's body. An hour later, when Lindsay and Tara were about to leave for the day, Lindsay took a phone call and was clearly agitated. "Ginger, can you deal with this?" she called, putting the call on hold. "It's the freaking Sharps pickup again." I rolled my eyes and took the phone, waving goodbye to her and Tara, and sticking a folded drawing I didn't want to lose in the front pocket of my overalls. After about 5 minutes of me politely explaining things to this jackass on the phone, Christopher came in, cheeks pink from the cold, and waved when he saw I was on the phone. "Yes, I'm aware of that," I said into the phone, blowing Christopher a kiss. "As I told you guys last month, that rate should stay the same for the shop because I negotiated it with Darren to remain fixed. This has already been discussed with Darren, so the price increase doesn't affect me. You just need to talk to Darren about it."
"Well, Darren's out of the country, and he didn't leave a note about it or anything."
"Listen, dude, I've said the same thing to you 4 times now, and you don't seem to be hearing me. Check the actual billing software, and you'll see that what I paid was for what I owed."
"Lady, the price went up for everyone. Is your boss there? Maybe he knows."
"Yeah, my fucking boss is here. It's me. How about you just check with Darren, and when he tells you that he and I have this deal, you can change it in your database or whatever so you don't have to call and make me explain it for the 3rd month in a row." He muttered into the phone, and though it was faint, the key words were unfucking mistakable. Every scrap of irritation that had been floating around all day was suddenly magnetized to the misogynistic dick brain on the phone, suggesting that I was fucking Darren to get a grandfathered price. I wanted to cut his fucking head off. "Excuse me? No, I am not Darren's girlfriend, and I don't appreciate the implication. Listen, fuck you, you fucking dick. Don't call me again, and don't have anyone else call me again until you talk to Darren. Eat shit." I slammed the phone down and smashed my fist into the desk, pens and paper skittering off onto the floor. The warning tingles of a migraine were radiating from my temple down the back of my neck. "Fuck." Christopher said. "Bad day?" I closed my eyes, took a deep breath through my nose, and said, "I want to kill everything."
"Yeah, that sounded kind of bad. What did he do to incur the wrath of Ginger?"
His tone was light, but the way he said it niggled at me, as if my wrath was a trap, lying in wait for some hapless fool to stumble into. He tried to fucking gaslight me that I didn't know what my rate of service was, even though I had a deal with his boss. It wasn't my wrath, it was me being clear that I wasn't going to let him up the price on me when we already had a deal. Christopher held his hands up in a gesture of peace, but it just touched a match to the flame, as if he now had to defend himself against my wrath. "Well, that's what you do in business, right? It's what you do, I know that."
"Yeah, sure," he said warily. "But you also don't want to totally alienate the people you get service from."
I didn't alienate. The anger and unfairness of the whole day had already used up every last scrap of patience, and my temples were pounding. "It's easier for you, Christopher," I bit off. "You don't get it, because when you tell the bagel guy that your order was wrong, he actually listens to you. He doesn't try and convince you that you placed the order incorrectly. He doesn't try and get you to pay for his mistake. He doesn't suggest that maybe the reason why you have the current standing price for bagels is because you are letting the owner of the bakery fuck you." Christopher's eyes widened and he opened his mouth, but I couldn't even countenance hearing his surprised outrage on my behalf. Because sometimes the outrage that can only be born of not knowing how much your own privilege shaped your world was as infuriating as the thing being outraged about. "I own a business, too," I went on. and I have to raise my voice, and I have to show people the proof that I'm right, and I have to be strict and not let people have an inch, because if I let them, they try to walk all over me. You can get away with being chill and laid back and asking nicely, and then you get to feel like the good guy, and that's fucking great for you. But don't think it's because you're just such a nice guy that people just want to do your bidding. You get to be that way because people grant you authority naturally. I have to fight to convince people I even own this place. So don't tell me how to run my business, and don't tell me how to talk to people who try to fuck with it.
Hey, he said, I work hard too, Ginger. I care about my business too. And I can't help it that people treat me the way they do.
I know that. I'm not blaming you. I'm saying don't come in here like you know what it's like to be me and tell me how to act.
He took a deep breath and pinched the top of his nose. Did something else happen?
Why? Because I couldn't possibly actually be mad at you, so it must be about something else?
Damn, Ginger, did I say that?
My hands were shaking and there was a pit in my stomach. The depth of the unfairness was oceanic and everything it touched just got pulled back under the waves. I was barreling down an avenue I couldn't see the end of. I dug my fingertips into my temple where the headache threatened. I was always the mean one, the one who had to be rude to get things done, the bitch. Then I had to be okay with being the bitch because it was what was necessary, and I resented everyone who came out smelling like roses. No, I get it. You're always a good guy, and you smile, and people are like, sure, Christopher, we'll get right on that order for you, and everything's fine, and your customers love you, and you know what everyone wants, and you just give it to them, and you can charm anyone, right? Christopher crossed his arms like he was about to deny it, and suddenly I was furious at him. Furious about all of it, even though I knew it wasn't his fault. Just radiating with bitterness and exhaustion that had been building all day. No, really, that must be so great. My voice shook and I swallowed bitter spit. I guess it's how you have all this energy left over to put up with my shit, huh? And to take care of Jude. I mean, shit, imagine if you didn't immediately have the respect of random people in the world and had to fight for it. I might have eaten nothing but Chinese takeout for months, and maybe Jude would have actually killed himself. I slammed my hand over my mouth as if I could keep the words inside, but it was too late. I shook my head in slow-motion horror. Christopher rocked backward, as if my words had slammed into him like bullets. His jaw was clenched so tight the tendons in his neck stood out, and his expression was one I'd never seen before. Pain and anger and shame and maybe betrayal. Like I had revealed that I wasn't who he thought I was. Christopher. I'm sorry, I didn't mean... He held up a hand like he couldn't bear to hear one more word from me. He opened his mouth, but nothing came out, and I took a step forward because there had to be something I could say to take it back. But he just said, stop. His voice choked and rough. And then he turned and walked out the door, spine straight and head dropped low, and there wasn't a fucking thing I could do to stop him. I stood, cemented to the floor, for a few horrible breaths. I felt like a tornado had ripped through the shop, tearing up everything inside me and leaving the rest untouched. Then I ran upstairs so I could freak out in private, because this time I had climbed up to the tallest platform. I had stood on the edge. I had held the rope in my hand, and instead of jumping, I'd set the rope on fire. Chapter 19. I spent 2 days sleeping, eating, showering, dressing, tattooing, and speaking to people like a human. I texted with Daniel about normal things like music and his second semester classes and weird clients who came into the shop. I made a schedule for getting my paintings done over the next 8 days, and I even amused myself by drawing a little menorah in each square, adding a candle as the days went on in homage to Hanukkah. It was going to be fine, right? On the third, I woke up in the middle of the night in a panic and tried to reassure myself by looking at the schedule to see that I had enough time to finish everything. Until I realized that wasn't what I was panicking about. I was mentally groping around for Christopher, for evidence of his presence, and finding only empty space. Then I broke. I twisted in on myself in a panic of fear and shame and self-loathing. I told myself every mean thing I thought in the middle of the night, every mistake, every shortcoming, every hurt. It was a controlled demolition, a ritual of psychic self-harm. I pulled every nasty thought around myself like a blanket and went deep. I couldn't cry. I couldn't yell. All I could do was lie there and tell myself over and over that it didn't matter what I did because I was selfish, mean, poisonous, egotistical, embarrassing. When I finally fell back asleep, it was like scratching a grave in the sere earth. A shallow, grasping comfort, unsatisfying and unprotected. For better or for worse, I forced myself to keep to my schedule. I'd already planned to take this last week before the show off from the shop so I could finish my paintings, only going downstairs a few times throughout the day to check on things. The first time I went down, Farron's eyes tracked me, his expression pitying. Morgan started to say something, something funny but cutting, no doubt, but Marcus elbowed her before she could. I looked away from him because it was too hard to maintain eye contact when I felt so ashamed for failing in a way that he was intimately familiar with. I painted for hours, manic and frenzied, stopping only when I had to use the bathroom or got so hungry I couldn't ignore it anymore. Going to the store was impossible, and even seeing someone who would deliver food felt excruciating, so I ate my way through all the open boxes of cereal that Christopher had bought for my birthday. I saved the Lucky Charms and Count Chocula that Christopher had chosen for himself for last, since I didn't like them. Kid cereal. Too sweet and too fake-tasting. But when they were all I had left, I ate them, forcing myself to linger over how much I had hurt Christopher with every sickly sweet bite. The knock at my door came when I was just on the verge of finishing a canvas, my eyes swimming with the strain. "What?" I yelled, assuming it was Marcus and Morgan. All the blood drained out of my head when the door opened and it was Jude. Farron was standing just behind him, towering over him and looking a bit confused. "I'm sorry," Farron said and gestured to Jude with a graceful hand. "He just ran up here." Jude turned to look at him, and whatever Farron saw in his face made him go very still. I wiped my hands on my overalls. Shame crawled around my throat at the idea of seeing Christopher's brother, especially when I'd turned his very presence into the weapon that dealt a quelling blow. It's okay, Farron. Thanks. Farron shot Jude an unreadable look and loped down the stairs. I ran a nervous hand through my hair, as if that would do any good, and only succeeded in getting paint in it. I was startled all over again at Jude's otherworldly appearance. His bright hair was just as messy as it had been at Christmas, but instead of being pulled back, it fell in his face in waves. He looked even paler, his freckles more dramatic. He had circles under his eyes, and he had his black wool coat wrapped tightly around himself. "Obviously, I didn't run," Jude said as he closed the door carefully behind him. Then he just looked at me. Arms crossed. "I'm so sorry," I blurted, shame strangling the words. He wasn't the one I should have been apologizing to, but somehow it came easily for him, where I hadn't yet found the words for Christopher. Jude cocked his head like he couldn't see what that had to do with anything and moved past me to examine the canvases around the room. They were all pieces of portraits, photorealistic to start, but then I'd pushed past realism to find the edge of strangeness in the ordinary human lines of them, heightened the contrast lightly between light and shadow, hard-lined the curve of bone beneath skin, wet a lip to mirror shine. Marcus's hand resting on his knee, the ink-spattered shop floor beneath his boot, the curve of Morgan's shoulder where it met her neck, and her profile with her hair blooming around her. Tara's skinny shoulders, her backpack hanging low and her head canted forward. He took his time looking, then stood before me without comment. It was the most nerve-wracking assessment I'd ever experienced. He sighed. Christopher wants to be loved. He sounded very tired and very certain of what he was saying. And he wants to be needed. That's what he's always wanted. What that means is that he will find someone to love him. He's made for it, so if you're done with him... I winced at the words, but you didn't even flinch. You can go about your business, secure in the knowledge that he'll be okay. I knew I should feel relieved at that, but it tore me apart all over again. I didn't want him to be okay because I didn't want him to be without me in the first place. He's destroyed right now. He loves you, and you shat on it. But he will get over it. He'll be fine, eventually. And once he's fine, someone else will find him. Someone else will love him, Ginger. He's very, very easy to love. And he'll love them back, eventually, because that's what Christopher does. Probably not as much as he loves you, but what does that really matter, huh? He will love them. And when that happens, it will be too late. There won't be any changing your mind or apologizing and trying again. Once Christopher is done, he's done. No looking back. Love. 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 The word had fallen from Jude's lips so many times it had lost its meaning. Did Christopher love me? Could he have, really? How? It was too late now, anyway. Tears were running down my cheeks at the thought of someone else loving Christopher. I hadn't cried once, not in all these days, but the image of someone else squeezing his arm in those weird colored t-shirts, of someone else touching the soft spot under his chin, of someone else eating the sandwiches he'd put together with his rough hands. And the thought of Christopher loving someone else, of never feeling the sunny warmth of his regard or seeing his beautiful eyes narrow in amusement at something I said, never hearing him snort when he found me ridiculous or want to hear the details of something that no one else would care about. The thought of all that care turned away from me and towards someone else. It opened a chasm inside me. Jude didn't respond to my tears at all. I'm telling you all this because I don't think you are done. I think you're scared, and I think you're not used to risking much. And I think you got very used to letting him be the one who made every move so that you never had to wonder if yours would be reciprocated. I'm quite familiar with that strategy, believe me. I have emotional stinginess down to an art. My guilt swelled. Emotional stinginess. Fuck. I'm not sure if you know this. Actually, I bet you don't, but Christopher has emailed or texted me every day since I ended up in that hospital. Sometimes more than once a day. He never missed a day, even once I got to our parents. Sometimes I wrote him back, and sometimes I couldn't, but regardless, he never stopped reaching out. He's the opposite of emotionally stingy. I nodded. I didn't know what to say. I just knew that I wanted Jude to keep talking, because he was talking about Christopher, and I loved the shit out of Christopher, and... Wait. 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 My heart was pounding so hard I could feel it in my ears, and I was sweating. When I looked back up at Jude, unblinking and startled, he paused. Then he seemed to slouch, his shoulders slumping and his hair covering his face. He looked exhausted, as if he had suddenly reached the end of his battery life. And given everything Christopher had said about Jude's tendency to hide in his room and not even come out for meals, I could wager a guess that it had taken a huge amount of energy for him to be here right now. Look, he said on a sigh, the crispness to his voice gone, replaced by something less cutting but more desperate. If you can't hack it, then, by all means, leave my brother alone, because he deserves someone who wants him.
But I've listened to him talk about you every day since the morning he found you on the floor of Melt, and if any part of this is about you not believing that he cares, let a third-party observer squash that doubt once and for all.
I slumped too, my head pounding, my eyes scratchy. Jude took a step toward me and bent down a little to look me in the eye.
I think I get it. A little. When things are overwhelming, the easiest thing to do, the safest thing to do, is hunker down. If you don't get anyone else involved, then no one can hurt you and you can't hurt anyone. Am I close?
I gave a jerky nod.
Don't think I can take my own advice or anything, he said archly. But it is shockingly clear when I'm watching someone else about to fuck everything up. Christopher is loyal, and he wants to be needed. He's the best person to have in your corner in those moments you hunker down. He's the best person to have in your corner, even when you don't want him there.
He wrapped his coat more tightly around himself and raked a pale hand through his messy hair. He turned his back and opened the door so slowly it was like it hurt him to move. Just before it shut, he looked right at me, his eyes burning like molten glass.
Don't fuck it up.
Then the door shut, and the silence echoed around me. An hour later, my phone chimed with a text. It was from an unfamiliar number and contained nothing but a picture. Framed in the doorway, Christopher stood, looking at me with such a worshipful expression it took my breath away. I was turning to look at him, my face a little blurred with movement, and I was reaching out my hand as if I wanted to touch him but couldn't quite let myself make contact. He was love and hope and appreciation. I was yearning and trepidation and the fear of grasping at nothing. I stared at the picture Jude had sent, because it must have been Jude, 100 times. I zoomed in to look at the expression that lit up Christopher's face so often that I could almost believe he still felt that way about me. Tender and fond and delighted by me. Just me. Then I cried. Great, tearing sobs that ripped me open and turned my stomach inside out. Then I painted. I didn't extract just the piece I wanted, as I had with the rest of the series. I didn't sharpen the lines or smooth the curves. I didn't adjust the lighting for more dramatic contrast. I didn't change the perspective to make a better composition. I painted it as it was in the picture, with the blip of an elbow in the lower left corner and the ugly wooden chair brought up from the basement, ruining the clean line of the doorway in the bottom right. I painted the expression that I had stared at in the picture as if I were seeing it for the first time. And maybe I was. I painted my own face, slightly blurred and unself-conscious, turning to look at Christopher as his family buzzed around us. And I painted my hand, reaching. Reaching and never touching. It wasn't the best thing I'd ever painted, not by a long shot. But it was maybe the most important. Because as I stared at my painted hand, more than anything in the world, I wished for it to make contact. When I first met Christopher, I thought of his happiness as obliviousness, as evidence that he hadn't been ravaged by the world. But Christopher wasn't some dude wandering around, oblivious of his privilege, uncaring of its cost. He'd said it several times. He'd done nothing to deserve his happiness. He'd meant it to underscore his guilt, but the truth was it cut just as easily the other way. He hadn't chosen his emotional makeup any more than I had, any more than Jude had. I'd resented him because it seemed like all of this was easier for him than for me, as if he sacrificed less, stood to risk less. And he did, in some ways, but what if instead of being jealous of his ease, I could absorb it? Instead of coveting his consistency, I could depend on it. Instead of resenting his resilience, I could lean on it. What if, with Christopher, I could burn the whole world down when I needed to, and he could extinguish a spot for us in the center of it. Carve out a safe space for us while the fire raged outside. Jude's words echoed in my head. Someone else will love him. He's very easy to love. It was true. And I also knew that the idea of someone else loving him, of him loving someone else, made my heart pound and my breath go shallow in horror. I wanted Christopher. I wanted him in my corner when shit was rough. I wanted him in my bed holding me. I wanted his sun to shine on me. I wanted to soak up his light like a moon and glow with it. I dialed Daniel's numbers with tears streaming down my face and pain all over me, and when he answered, I choked out, "I love him, and I think I really fucked up, and I need you to convince me I can fix it." Chapter 20. I dragged the wood from the Italian market back to my apartment, snow falling in fat flakes that coated my hair like I was an ice cream dipped in sprinkles. Carlo had made the predictable jokes about giving me his wood, but once those had run their course, he'd bored holes in the wood for me and thrown in some soprasada for good measure, even though I hadn't been there for food this time. "This for one of your art projects?" he'd asked. "Nope, it's a sign. A love letter, maybe? Well, letters, plural, on the sign." My voice had sounded manic, even to me. "You feeling okay, hon?" Carlo had asked, clearly concerned. "No, not even a little, but I'm going to fix it." "Good luck," he called after me, saluting me with a sausage. For all that I'd teased Christopher about the melt sign, I'd never actually considered an alternative, but that was the project before me. I was going to hand-paint Christopher a new sign, and it would be my offering when I apologized for being an asshole and told him I wanted to try and make our relationship work, really work. I had tattooed lettering in styles that ranged from typewriter to elaborate cursives to Wild West Saloon. The trick was finding the right font to convey the vibe, and then making it both beautiful and readable. Really, Melt's vibe was Christopher's vibe. Comfortable, welcoming, honest, delicious. It was a neighborhood joint with a non-traditional take on traditional sandwiches, so that was what the sign should be. I took a gamble and used color, though the inside of Melt was mostly black and white. It was eye-catching and bold, a deep turquoise for the lettering and a bright plum for the border. There was nothing else on the street with that color combination, and they looked beautiful together. I sketched out the font, slowly trying different sizes and different lettering-to-border ratios on scrap paper until I found the perfect combination. And then I painted into the night, propping the wood up so I could paint both sides at once, since I didn't have time to let one dry before I painted the other. As the sun rose, it lit the turquoise and plum, setting them on fire. It was bold but comfortable, vibrant but calm, classic but with a sense of whimsy. It was Melt. It was Christopher. It was perfect. From the beginning, we'd both been looking for signs that this thing between us could work. Now, I was going to hand him as concrete a sign as I possibly could, so there would be no doubt about how I felt. An hour into the show, I finally relaxed a little. This was likely due in part to the free wine, and in part to the fact that I simply couldn't sustain the stress of whipping around Linda Blair-like every time someone walked through the door to see if it was Christopher. I'd fallen into bed for a couple of hours after I finished painting Christopher's sign, before I made my way over to the gallery. When I'd woken up, I'd sent Christopher a text, telling him that I was so sorry for being horrible, that I really hoped he'd come to the show, and that I'd like to talk with him afterward if he was willing. Then I forced myself to turn off my phone so I'd stop looking at it every 6 seconds, take a shower for the first time in days, and focus on the fact that I had my first solo show in a real gallery, rather than the fact that I'd potentially ruined my relationship. I'd put on the brightest dress I owned in the hopes of cheering myself from the outside in. It was turquoise with bright red poppies that looked like they'd been spray-painted onto it. I wore my cowboy boots because they had a bit of heel, and if there was ever a moment I could stand to feel taller, tonight was it. Malik and I had spent hours hanging and lighting the paintings, and I was really pleased with the outcome. When you walked in the gallery space, you were immediately confronted with the painting of Marcus's hands, the style and the contrast setting the tone for the whole show. By the time you wended your way through the gallery, you'd seen bits and pieces of people, each one inviting you to look closely at their details. Ed hung the painting of Christopher and me at the back of the gallery, and the impression was that after looking at a lot of art, he stumbled onto a candid scene. Something intimate, private, natural. The response had been great so far. Folks wandering in off the street, mingling with people who knew me or Malik or the gallery scene. Malik's friend was playing DJ, and rather than the usual art-opening cheese cube platter, Malik's husband, who was an amazing cook, had made miniature tamales and churros. I was talking to Marcus when he walked in. Christopher. I felt him. Like a little zing, a charge in the air. My relief at seeing him was matched only by my nerves at the apology I'd have to make. I was overcome by how much I wanted him. By how right it seemed that he would walk right over to me because, of course, he belonged at my side. And how wrong it felt that he wasn't. Jude was with him. And as they stood next to each other, I was struck by the way their features were versions of one another spun off in opposite directions, by the way things can resonate with each other but still seem so different. When Christopher caught my eye, I smiled automatically, before I remembered that maybe I didn't have the right to just smile at him anymore. My smile faltered, but he held my gaze, and it was like we were having a conversation across the room. When I started to make my way toward him, though, he waved me off with a gesture that clearly said, "This is your time. We'll talk when it's over," and turned to Jude. I spent the next hour chatting with folks while I tracked Christopher out of the corner of my eye. I collected several cards from collectors and gallery owners, sold 3 paintings, and grabbed the last tamale off the tray right out from under the hand of some dude who looked like he'd wandered in accidentally on his way to a shareholders meeting. When most people had left, I found Christopher standing in front of the painting of us at the back of the gallery. I went to him with my heart pounding and my stomach clenched. "Hope you're not going to sue me for image infringement," I joked nervously. He turned to me, and his expression was naked longing. "I seriously don't have the words to describe how amazing you are. The paintings, they're... and this one... you blow me away." Warmth flowed through me, enough to power my tiny engine of bravery. I reached out a hand for him, like I could rewrite the ending to the painting's story. The feel of his arm beneath my fingers was like groping around in the strange dark and finally touching something familiar. "Can we talk?" He nodded, then scanned the gallery. Jude was standing near the door next to Farron, and they were talking, heads close together, Farron's fingers resting lightly on Jude's arm. When Christopher caught Jude's eye, Jude nodded and waved him off, following Farron outside. "I missed you," Christopher said, low and sincere. And the generosity of that nearly undid me. My voice caught in my throat. "Me too," I choked out. "So much." I still had my hand on Christopher's arm, and I let my hand drop, trying to figure out how to say what I needed to say. "So," he said, turning so we were both facing the painting. "Who bought it?" "What?" "Oh." I looked at the blue sticker on the wall next to the painting. "No one. It's for you." "Of course it's for you."
"Seriously?"
"You can hang it next to the Melt Monster Mountain Stream painting." He stared at the painting, and I stared at him. "Listen, I need to apologize," I started to say. "In a minute," he murmured, still staring at it. We stood in silence in front of the painting, and I wondered if he saw what I did. Him offering me everything and me longing for it, but scared. "Will you come back to my place? I have something for you, and we can talk."
"Yeah, okay."
His voice was small, nervous, but he followed me. We walked in silence, and I tried to plan out what I would say, but just as had happened over the last few days, nothing sounded right. And I found myself unlocking the door to my apartment, no closer to finding the words than I had been before.
Jesus Christ,
Christopher said, coughing. He walked over and threw open the two large living room windows.
Ginger, it's fucking toxic in here.
I sniffed the air, but I guess I was used to the smell, because it didn't seem too bad to me. At my shrug, he made a face, but his exasperation didn't have teeth, and I felt a jolt of hope streak through me. I thought maybe if I got you high on paint fumes, you would just agree to anything, I joked nervously. He raised an eyebrow and said nothing. Okay, well, I'm sorry I was such a jerk. I never should have said that about me and Jude. I can't believe I said that. I was so mad, and sometimes when I get mad, I don't express myself very well. I'm so, so sorry. I really want to do the thing, the us being together thing. And I love you. Christopher cocked his head and squinted.
Sorry, what was that last bit?
I didn't quite. He cupped a hand around his ear. My heart hammered in my chest and my palms were sweaty. I rolled my eyes at him. I said, I love you, I snapped. That sounded more aggressive than I meant it. Christopher walked over to me, the breadth of his chest and the heat of his body solace in the cold air and the days of loneliness in my apartment. He was looking down at me, eyes burning with desire and hope and anger and...
I love you isn't magic, you know. It doesn't fix everything.
It's a little bit magic, I said, and he smiled in spite of himself. But yeah, I know that. That's why I started with the sorry part and the wanting to be together part. Did it work? The paint fumes? He shook his head, and my heart fell. I rummaged around in my brain for the words. I closed my eyes, because it was easier if I couldn't see him. Couldn't see everything I might have already lost. The other day, what I said about you, about Jude, I didn't mean that. I didn't mean it at all. The rest of the stuff I mostly did mean, but none of it was about you doing anything wrong. That was just about the world. I took a deep breath, but didn't open my eyes. Everything good in my life has been a result of me not compromising, not taking the status quo as a given, going for it with all my energy. I guess I've always had this feeling that if I started making choices with other people in mind, or if I took time that I could be spending on my art or on the business, on other things, that I'd lose what I've spent so long building. That I'd lose sight of what I wanted. That I couldn't have both things. But I've realized lately that I've been thinking about it wrong. That I want... At Christopher's touch on my cheek, I let my eyes drift open.
What do you want?
He asked softly, eyes riveted to me. I want someone in my corner, I said, remembering Jude's words. I want someone who has their own goals and we can support each other, make each other better. I want to be... What the fuck is that thing? If Daniel says the word all the time. Oh, maybe I should text him.
You are not texting Daniel for thesaurus options while you're in the middle of declaring your damn love for me.
I made a mental note to tell Daniel about my phone a friend impulse later and smiled at Christopher. It's the thing where two things together are more powerful than either of them apart, I explained.
Like a Care Bear stare?
Christopher offered seriously, and I started cracking up. No. Well, actually, kinda. Like in Captain Planet when they combine their powers, wind, fire, earth, water, I forget the rest.
Heart,
Christopher said wryly. Oh, right. Jeez, that show was amazing. Oh, synergy.
I don't think that was one of them.
No, the word. Synergy, where the power of the combined things is more than they are alone.
I prefer Care Bear stare,
Christopher said. Fine, whatever.
Care Bear stare. I had a point.
What you want?
Yes. I want to have someone where we make each other better and amplify each other's power.
I have to tell you,
Christopher said, voice low, eyes intent.
I'm going to think of it as our Care Bear stare, and nothing you say will stop me.
Christ, fine. Yes, sure, okay. Think of it however you want, I muttered, shaking my head.
Ginger.
Christopher put his hands on my shoulders and leaned down so our faces were close. All traces of teasing were gone.
I'm ridiculously fucking in love with you. You've got to figure some shit out, I know. We both do. I'm not too concerned about it. I think we're going to be just fine.
You do?
I do. Look, I'm not saying it's going to be easy. The people don't automatically know how to be in relationships with each other just because they love each other.
The word love felt like a caress.
But we'll figure it out. I promise.
I was such a dick, I said, fisting the front of his sweater. I'm so sorry.
I know. It's okay. I'm sorry I was oblivious about how business stuff is for you.
Thanks. So, are we... Like, what's the protocol here? I cringed, but Christopher laughed.
I think now we kiss the shit out of each other.
Yeah, great. Good plan. I murmured, eyes locked on his mouth. Christopher's lips met mine, mouth hot and sweet and possessive. Everything I was afraid I'd never feel again. I wrapped my arms around his neck and kissed him back with all I had. The feel of his body against mine was so right, I couldn't believe I'd even spent a minute wondering if I needed him in my life. Oh, I said, breaking the kiss, I have something for you.
Oh, yeah?
He asked, voice dark and low. His eyes raked my body. That, too, I said, running a hand up his stomach to his chest. But in a minute. I tugged him across the room. You know your crappy sign? I made a ta-da flourish toward the sign I'd painted. He knelt down in front of the melt sign, then looked up at me. You like it? He stood up and towered over me, silent. Is that a yes? His eyes were intense and his nostrils flared. No? He grabbed me, picking me up. What the hell? He dropped me onto the bed and knelt, looking at me. And I could see it. I could see everything.
I love it, he said. I love you. You're amazing.
My smile was so big, it hurt my face. Because looking up at him, love and respect and admiration shining down at me, it was like looking into the goddamn sun. Epilogue. 1 month later. I'd been tattooing at the Philly Tattoo Convention for practically a decade, but this year it felt entirely new. Yesterday, my booth had been so busy, I'd barely had time to take sips of water between schmoozing, tattooing, and catching up with other industry folks I only ever saw at this con. I'd slept for maybe 2 hours last night after raucous post-con karaoke and was currently standing near the side entrance trying to figure out on my phone where the nearest coffee in the sprawling convention center was. Of course, the con app didn't do anything so useful as point out coffee or bathrooms, and I shut it in disgust, resigning myself to wandering aimlessly until I found it, or stalking someone walking with a cup. An arm snaked around me from behind, and Christopher's smell washed over me, as comforting and calming as ever. Then the smell of coffee hit me, and I whipped around, twisting to get at the cup in his other hand. Jeez. He said, shaking his head after my hair slashed him in the face. I guess I know where I stand. I nodded, took a huge sip of coffee, and closed my eyes in relief. Thank God. I kissed him in thanks, then let myself relax in his embrace for a moment before I faced the chaos of the con.
Ready?
We walked to my booth hand in hand, but when we got there, all I could see was a chattering mob of people.
What the hell? I murmured, bracing for some drama.
The fallout after I'd posted my thoughts on gender in the tattoo industry had been mostly positive after the initial onslaught of trolls and assholes, but now that I was firmly entrenched in social media, I was constantly primed for the next inevitable flare-up. The group fell suspiciously silent as I approached, the people elbowing one another and turning to look at me. It felt like the time in 10th grade that Nancy Watson had spread the rumor I was sleeping with our chemistry teacher, and groups of students had paused in their conversations to stare at me as I walked down the hall, clueless as to what was going on. But then Christopher squeezed my arm, and a woman standing in front of me smiled huge. I recognized her. It was Sally, the woman whose tattoo I'd used to kick off United Inc. "Hey, Ginger," she said, and I grabbed her in a hug. She unpinned her sleeve to show me and the rest of the group the tattoo of half a best friend's necklace above her amputation. The woman standing next to her rolled up her own sleeve to reveal the other half. "It's so good to see you again," I said, overwhelmed. Then, as I looked around the crowd, I saw that a lot of the women were holding pictures. "Some folks here to meet you," Sally said, and I realized who they were. They were people who had posted pics of their tattoos in the United Inc. campaign, holding printouts of their posts. "Holy shit," I said, recognizing one after another. Carmen Montez was there with her sisters and her mom and her arm around her grandmother. There was a heavily tattooed woman who'd posted a picture of the tattoo she'd gotten with her best friend after they'd run their first Spartan race. And others, so many others. Everywhere I looked was strength. Camaraderie, support. Evidence that when we lifted each other up, we all benefited. My throat got tight, and I felt a suspicious burning in my eyes. "I can't believe this. How did you all..."
"Talk to your man," a low voice said to my left. "He set it up."
"Holy shit," I breathed, because that
was Etta Blake in the damn flesh.
She smiled, as striking in person as she was in pictures, if shorter than I'd imagine. She embraced me, said we'd get dinner later, and then started talking to others in the crowd. After meeting everyone, I turned, searching out Christopher. He'd stayed on the outskirts of the crowd, giving me my space. Now, though, I could feel his eyes on me.
"I can't believe you did all this," I said, wrapping an arm around his waist.
"Happy Valentine's Day," he said.
And shit, it was Valentine's Day, wasn't it? "Oh my God, you total cheeseball. I hope you know I didn't get you anything."
He snorted. "Right, because I've never met you."
Then he gave me that grin that never failed to make me feel like I was held in the warmest, fiercest hug. I went up on tiptoes and whispered in his ear, feeling him shiver against me.
"I love you."
"Damn right," he said and kissed me.
I could hear voices all around us and heavy metal music from down the hall, but Christopher was more vivid than any of it. His mouth on mine, his arm around me, and my hand resting on his arm right over the fresh tattoo, synergy, that matched my own. He'd carry that piece of me with him, marked forever as mine.
This concludes Small Change by Roan Parrish, narrated by Joe Raylan, member SAG-AFTRA. Copyright 2017 by Roan Parrish. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Roan Parrish, care of Handspun Literary Agency, and was produced in the year 2019 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.